Marta.
I first met Marta when I had my store on Bass Avenue in the very early 80s. And we were doing one of our first big production banana shows at the St. Peter's Club. And Marta came in, had recently moved to town with this friend of hers. And she said, I want to help. I want to be involved. And I'm like, well, you know, we have everything we already need. I didn't know her. And she's very pushy. And I said, finally, I said, well, the only thing we don't have is lights. And she said, we could do lights. We could do the lights. I said, okay, if you can figure it out. Well, in the meantime, Marta had a new boyfriend named Michael. And guess who did the lights? So for the next, 15 years or whatever, every time we did a show, it was Michael doing the lights. But Michael and Marta, they got married 27 years ago tomorrow. At their anniversary, and I was the best man. And then she moved away, and we were all sad. But she had some epic bananas roles. The one most epic was Tina Turner. And we still have it on video. So, but I'd like to present Marta Alba.
Wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate that little trip down memory lane. It's wonderful to be back to my adopted hometown. And I have my little notes because otherwise I can start rambling and we don't want that. I want to welcome everybody here and thank you. My name is Marta Alba, and I am the author of American Tumbleweeds. The reason somebody was asking about my name, and actually my pen name is my real name, my first and middle name, and I decided to drop the last names because it would be too long. I would have to include both families, and the name would just drop off the cover. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it real easy here. But like I said, it's a pleasure being back to this wonderful place, Gloucester. And I'd like to thank the Gloucester Writer Center, particularly Henry Farini, and of course Richard, with always adding a little touch of entertainment. Michael, my husband, we did the edition. It's actually 32 years, right, that we've been married. And like Richard said, he was our best man. Thank you. So what I've been doing tonight, well, what I've been doing during this tour, we've been through New York, upstate, Philadelphia. We're here, and then we're heading back to New York City. Actually, Saturday we have a Peabody reading. Then we go back to New York City, and then we end up the tour in New Jersey. In October, we start our Southwest, which includes New Mexico and Texas and Colorado. So going to be a little busy. What I've been doing, I've been receiving a lot of questions about this novel, and what I've decided the way to address them is I will mention some of those questions and discuss my writing process as we go along and read some of the selections as illustrations about how I've came about to this, to illustrate this point. I know some of you have already read the novel, and I thank you so much. It's been receiving amazing reviews, and I appreciate your support. And if I could ask one more big favor, if you haven't done so, please write a review wherever you purchased it, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever. That'll help my publisher, and it'll help me hopefully get another novel published. So storytelling and writing is an art form, like any art form, music, painting, that is sometimes best left to the interpretation of the reader. But sometimes, every now and then, you inspire somebody. And as writers, as artists, we always like to encourage other people to continue, you know, that inspiration. So that's kind of what I'm going to do. Before I go any further, there are a couple of people here who were crucial to my career in film and television. And one of them is Seneca Nogallo, who's over there, who allowed me to internship at Cablevision and then hired me later on when I was attending Emerson College. And the other person I had met in Gloucester, and then she left. And I was pretty bummed out because she was somebody that I was looking up to, but she went on to become a very successful producer in film, and that's Sarah Green, who gave me my first break in film. And from there, she also allowed me to stay in her apartments in New York City, which was a big help to get to network. So thank you very much to both of you. So here is one of the questions that I've always been asked, is my inspiration for writing American Tumbleweeds. And basically, the inspiration came from my desire to share my life with people that I didn't think really were familiar with that area. It kind of actually, the idea came in when I arrived to Gloucester, and I realized that every time I said, you know, where are you from? They asked, where are you from? And I'd say, Texas. And it'd be like, no, but where are you really from? I'd be like, okay, well, I moved here from New Mexico. Oh, well, how long have you been in the country? And I'm like, no, New Mexico's part of, you know, the states. And I realized, particularly back then, we're talking 30 years or so ago, before there, you know, the internet, and we were. I mean, the states, you kind of travel. If you traveled around, you became familiar with the different regions of our country. But if you didn't, you didn't really understand what was going on. Now, life on the border today, of course, is drastically different than than in 1967 when my story takes place. What hasn't changed are the ancestral ties that bind human beings together. For example, Mexicans. We are native to the West Coast and Southwest of the United States. And our roots run deep because they've been planted there for centuries. Not just decades, but centuries. Yet from time to time, we need to be reminded of that, all of us. And in this first paragraph that I'm going to read, I have my 13-year-old protagonist, who is one of the main characters in the novel. There's about four or five, but she learns a little bit of history in her classroom. And let me read, I just want to make sure I have the right page. In this section, her teacher, they're in the classroom, and her teacher is discussing a dispute that's about to be settled in between El Paso and Mexico. And this is how it goes. Students, today I'd like to discuss a matter about to be settled in our city. It's a dispute that started in 1910. That's a long time to be mad, Ricardo says. The class laughs. Ricardo, please raise your hand if you have any comments. Now, can someone tell me what is the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo about and why is it so important? Lalo, of course, is the only one to raise his hand. The treaty ended the Mexican-American War. Correct. The United States and Mexico signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo on February 2, 1848. On that day, the Mexican government surrendered to the United States the territories that would become the states of New Mexico, Texas, Utah, California, Arizona, and Nevada. And the Mexican residents of these territories became Americans. You'll have to read my book to find out what that debate was about that was settled finally in 1967. The point is that Mexicans were in North America long before the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo separated the land and the battle started among neighbors. For people like me, I know where I belong because my genes and my blood are Mexican, but my heart and my mindset are American, and therefore I consider my soul Mexican-American. Now, American Tumbleweeds is ultimately about family. My publisher puts it best when she says, that these tumbleweeds portray every family, loving and clinging, wounding each other deeply while comforting each other in the soul-deep ways that only families can reach. I think we all know the family dynamics are similar regardless of heritage and culture. Now, my intent was to use the relationship between these two families. It's the same branch, but one of them lives in the United States and one of them lives in Mexico. And I wanted to use the relationship as a metaphor between the United States and Mexico, which my book describes as a love, hate, ambivalence of mutual need and recrimination. The scene I'm about to read provides an example of the tension between these two families. In it, Inés's mother, Catalina, confronts her in-laws, accusing Inés's uncle, Emilio, of embezzling money from a business belonging to her parents to Inés's parents. And here. So this is from the point of view of Catalina, Inés's mother. Ramón wants to know why the cantina hasn't sold yet, I say. I'm doing my best. Emilio removes a cigarette from Amalia's pack of fados. It's been almost 3 months. You said there had been some interest. I stop to light a cigarette. What happened? Don't you trust me, Catalina? Are you spending the earnings of La Cantina? I blurt out without thinking. ¡Qué descaro! Amalia confronts me. How dare you accuse my son of stealing when we are in agony over Savino? The tavern isn't a profitable business. Emilio quietly lights a cigarette. That's not what you've told people, I say. The business belongs to Ramón, Patricia grumbles. I'm Ramón's wife. La Cantina is our business. I need money to feed my kids. Frustrated, I snub out the cigarette I lit moments ago. Pay Emilio then, can't work for free just because they're brothers. Emilio told you, there is no money to give you, Catalina, Amalia insists. Why didn't you feed the children with the money Alejandro gave you? Emilio's accusation stuns me. That money was for Ramon's bail. Yeah, and my brother's still in jail. You know there wasn't enough money to get him out, and you convinced me to spend some of it on repairs for La Cantina. Emilio, I know you've taken from our home in the past. Now you're taking from our business. Atrevida, Amalia screeches. You're so brazen. My boys were raised with values. So the point I'm trying to make by highlighting these confrontations is that the underlying forces of family dynamics, as I mentioned before, are pretty much universal. We all have our confrontations. And although our experiences make us different, we do not need to allow those differences. We must celebrate them, not allow them to separate us. Because we share the same emotions, which basically are ego, pride, sympathy, and regret. And so that is kind of the basis that I was going with on this tension between these families. The big question I'm often asked is whether this novel is biographical. Well, as most writers know, all writing is cathartic. You really can't write without either putting a little bit of yourself or your experiences in your writing, because personal struggles are really perfect fodder for character building. That's what gives characters that three-dimensional experience that everybody can either relate to. If you don't relate to it, then you kind of lose the connection. But one of the things that I did in this book, even though it's fiction, I do draw from heavily on personal experience and my family history. When I started writing it, I wanted to share the culture, and that the more I wrote, the more I realized, wow, this kind of resembles the family history here. So let's see what the more you go into it, it changes and evolves. And before you know it, there's parts of it that are really very similar, for good or bad, depending on the people that are involved. Now, for example, like Ines, my young friend here, I was born in Mexico. My mother was born in the United States, but she was raised in Mexico. Around the early 50s, her and my father moved back to El Paso. Well, my father hadn't. My father was, that was the first time my dad had moved over. But when the time came that they knew I was on my way, my mother decided to cross the border into what is Mexico so that my great-grandmother, who was a midwife and had delivered everybody before me, would be, in charge of my birth. So that's how I ended up being born in Juarez, even though my family lived in El Paso, which to this day I tell my mom, gee, thanks, now I can't ever be president of the United States. Darn. But this paragraph with Inez is... illustrates Inez becoming a citizen. And like with me, it's a confusing situation for her because she doesn't quite understand what's going on. When I was in the fifth grade, Papa took me to the federal courthouse to become an American. Why? I asked him. You must become a ciudadana americana, he said, smiling. Without papers, you're a mojada. An undocumented Mexican is an illegal, and we can't have that. I worried. Mojada means wetback, and kids tease you with that word all the time. How come I'm not an American citizen already? Because your mother wanted Ama Lucia to be the one to deliver you when you were born. Since your great-grandmother can't come to the United States, your mother, Catalina, went to Mexico. At the courthouse, a man told me to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I knew it by heart because I had learned it in the first grade. Congratulations, Ines. You are now an American, the man said. I thought living in America made me an American, I said. He chuckled. You're lucky your mama was born in this country. As a child, the only thing that matters is for you to live among people who love you. You don't understand the politics or the consequences of crossing that border even. You know, it's just a natural thing. Now, there are other similarities between my childhood and the novel. But unlike a memoir, fiction allows you to the freedom to create, to become more creative and use your imagination. Because there are things that, even from family history, I remember, you know, I would hear these things, well, you know, the family always was in Texas, but then my great-grandfather decided to go to Mexico, and you're like, well, why? What's all that about? So that allowed me to do a little research about the time, you know, that period, the 1930s, about what was going on in the United States and why would they decide to go back to Mexico. So now one of the challenges of writing is to entertain while you inform. Fortunately, the 1960s was a very entertaining era. And in my book, I utilize music and fashion to add a little levity to the conversation. In this section that I'm about to read, Inez is walking toward a group of girls in the schoolyard, and she's recalling the first time she met two of her girlfriends. When Inez joins the group, her friends are doing what teen girls do best. They're criticizing their critics and scrutinizing each other's fashions. I like hanging out with Laura and her sisters. They're fun to be with. Even if Yoli, the oldest sister, taunted me when we first met. You still listen to the Beatles? She asked. Don't you know the Beatles are dead? James Brown, he's the man, the king of soul. Besides, the Beatles play stomper music. What is soul? I asked. And what does stomper mean? Stompers are gringos who dance funny, Laura explained. I roared with laughter when Laura stomped the floor to demonstrate. And this, Yoli dropped the turntable needle on a record, this is soul. James Brown's voice came screeching through the speakers. Let's do the jerk, Liz hollered, jerking her short body until her wavy hair fell over her eyes. It's hard to believe Liz and Laura are twins. Liz is short and chubby, and her short, wavy hair almost looks blonde. Laura has long, dark hair, and her long legs make her look like a baby giraffe learning to walk at birth. This morning, Liz is her usual sassy self. Why do you bother with the snob sisters? She asks when I join the group of girls after talking to my old friends. Sylvia and Linda aren't sisters, Laura says. They're just snobs. Everyone laughs except me. Those socks your friends wear make them look like fucking kids. Mona, one of the trendiest girls in school, puts down my friends. I'm not sure I like Mona, although I love her twiggy haircut. When I begged my mom for the same cut, she had no idea what I was talking about. Twiggy, I said, pointing to a picture of the English model who was all the rage. For those of you who don't know who Twiggy was, she was, I believe, the first supermodel, and she kind of took over the world in our generation. Music and fashion also helped to show the passage of time. Later in the book, I show how this is illustrated. I'm just looking for the page. Here we have Inez reflecting on her summer vacation. And the summer of 1967 is being called the Summer of Love. The Beatles released a new album called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. You can't dance to it, but Mrs. Rogers was right. The Beatles changed music forever with psychedelic rock. For me, this was the summer Papa went away and missed two big events in my life, entering my eighth year of school and falling in love. Today is the first day of school, and it's thrilling and terrifying all at once. First graders run around the courtyard like children playing hide and seek, while us eighth graders check each other out, our outfits and hairstyles, and the new kids who transferred. This year, Liz and I are classmates. I already miss Laura. Wow, Liz points across the courtyard. Look at Mona's hair. Mona dyed her hair blonde and is letting her twiggy haircut grow out. Again, for those of you who were there, that transition went from everybody letting their hair grow and grow and grow and grow. Just kept going. Now, as far as selecting writing themes, I like to write about things that interest me and hope that I tell the story well enough so that the reader is also finds themselves interested. I remember hearing rumblings about the building of a wall along the United States and Mexico border back in 1999. And it was kind of a whispering thing, you know, maybe we'll try it, whatever. Well, that brought back a memory that I had of the first time our government locked down the international border. And it was actually the day President Kennedy was shot. Well, I fretted. I was probably 10 or 11, and I freaked out because my grandmother lived on the Mexican side. We were in Texas, and I thought I was never going to see her. You know, as a child, you don't understand that the border is going to be open in 2 or 3 days. So I wanted to capture some of the memories that I had crossing the bridge between Juarez and El Paso. And I did that. I'm missing the chapter that with Inez going across the bridge. But basically what consisted of crossing the bridge was when I lived with my grandmother, she would get us up early. There was a trolley that went across the bridge that connected Mexico and the United States. And we would spend the whole day, my cousins, I lived with my grandmother till I was probably 5 or 6. And so I loved going to El Paso because it was such a different, it was a different contrast, but yet I felt comfortable in both countries. The one thing that I found out about myself after writing this is that I had never considered myself an immigrant. I always considered myself it was like I had a foot in each country and was comfortable in both. And so it wasn't until, like I said before, that you go into different parts of the country and you realize, oh, okay, that, you know, it's a different concept for people who don't live there, because it's a culture that melts very much. You have the Native American culture there, have African Americans, and of course the Latino and European people of European ancestry. So it's very, you just don't think about it. It's like New York City, you know, everybody's there. So anyway, what I wanted to have people take away from this is basically that we are at a point where America may not be able to take in all the poor and tired, huddled masses. But I hope we never give up our humanity, because respectful discussion, even when heated, is more productive than screaming and shouting. And I hope you enjoyed this book, and that it, I didn't write it for political reasons, but I wrote it because, like I said, I started it 10, 12 years ago. And what happens, a lot of times you write for yourself, like I said, and then every now and then you get very lucky and your story goes straight into the headlines. And that's what happened here. When my publisher read the story, she loved it, and then all of a sudden the political climate started, you know, gearing up for the election, and she realized, well, maybe this is a good time to get it published and get it out there. So I hope you enjoyed the journey.